Well, David, we have to have a battery change. If something can go wrong, it will. That's one of the laws of physics, I think. But we're back recording again, and I want to get into what you do with respect to supplements. And I want you to tell the story of your mother, her cancer, her supplements, her desire to live, and see if you can help people understand that they, if they need supplements, they need them continuously.
Sure. Well, I had gotten into nutrition and supplements years before, but I had just sort of started doing it professionally. And I got a phone call that my mom, her cancer had come back. She had had breast cancer somewhere around 12 years or more before. And, of course, never changed her diet, never took any supplements. She just had the surgery done, a little bit of radiation. And therefore, since you don't make any changes, it will probably come back again because you're still the same body with the same fertile ground for cancer. So her cancer came back. I get a phone call. And she had let it get pretty bad. So by the time I heard about it, because I'm in California, she was in New York where I was brought up, she was in bed previous to the phone call, because when I got the phone call, she was in the hospital already, and the cancer had gone up and down her spine, in her rib cage, in her hip, in her brain, or in her skull, rather, not in her brain, and she was in so much pain that when they came to take her, to bring her to the hospital, they could not put her in a wheelchair, because bending her back to sit up would have been too painful. They had to lift her into a gurney and run that through the various different doors with her laying totally down. So here she's in the hospital, doctor's hospital in New York, and I visit her there. And the first thing I did was find the oncologist, and there were two that were working on her case, and I spoke to the two of them, and I said, so, what can you tell me about my mom's condition? And they said, well, it's critical, it's fatal, I mean, she's going to die from it. I said, well, give me a rough idea of how long she's got to live. And they said, 3 months, 3-4 months. And I was, really? I mean, you're being that accurate? And they both said, well, you know, this is what we do all day long. You know, this is what we see. And yes, when we see this, she's got about 3 months to live. And I made a joke out of it, and I said, don't you believe in miracles? And one of the oncologists said, sure, we believe in miracles. She could last 4 months. I said, that's a pretty small miracle. How about a big miracle? Fine, she could last 5 or 6 months, don't count on it. And so I go into her room to talk to her, give her a hug. She's in bed. She's already had some chemotherapy. She's been in a hospital for a number of days before I flew in. And I said, Mom, would you like my help in fighting the cancer? Because I know that my mother was not really interested in that kind of thing, and she was just going to say no. And she blew me away, and she said, sure, I'll do anything you want. I'm thinking, really? This must be somebody else's mother that just looks like my mother. I said, you'll do anything I want? She said, whatever you want. She said, as soon as they release me to be home, whatever you want me to do, I'll do. So we went looking and hired a cook to make the food for her that I wanted, which was basically no starch, no sugar, lots of various different colors of non-starchy vegetables, lots of the good fats, extra virgin olive oil, butter, organic coconut oil, organic palm oil, all the fats that the public thinks are bad for you, but they're actually good for you. And none of the bad fats, no canola oil, no soybean oil, you know, none of the ones that actually are horrible, but again, the public doesn't know it. And I said, I'm going to send you a whole bunch of nutritional supplements. There's going to be a bunch of capsules, you know, some powders, some liquids, and I'll send them with directions for how the person is caring for you, because she still couldn't feed herself. She was in too much pain. You know, how they have to give you these, how often, with food, away from food. She said, whatever you want. So I send all this stuff in, and they start giving it to her. And she was on a very strong pain patch, which has been in the news a lot lately because it's being used to, by illegal people. It's called fentanyl. It's a very, very strong pain patch. And she was on the highest dose of fentanyl, and you have to move the patch, take it off, and put another one on every 3 days. And you put it in a different place, usually on the chest. And she would start screaming before the end of the third day, put the new patch on, because the pain was bleeding through. Within a couple of months of her eating the way I wanted her to eat, no starch, no sugar, lots of great foods, and taking all the supplements I'd sent in, of which there were many, she no longer was screaming for the pain patch to be changed. They would just change it on the third day. With another couple of months, she forgot about the patch and wouldn't say a word, and so they didn't change it to see what would happen, and she didn't start to say anything until like day number four or so. So they started reducing the pain medication until they got to the lowest possible dose of fentanyl that existed in the patch. And after a number of months, she didn't really even need that. The only reason that she was on it is because fentanyl, like all other barbiturates, is addicting, and she would start to have withdrawal symptoms on day maybe number five if they didn't give her a new patch. And I didn't want to have to deal with withdrawal symptoms also, so I said, just wait until she said she's not feeling good, and then go ahead and put the new patch on at the lowest dose in another place. And we just continued to do this. She only had two jobs, to eat all these good things that were being prepared for her and refuse any garbage sweets that would be brought up by people that were visiting her, and take all the supplements and let me know if she is low on anything so I could get her refills before there were a problem. I start getting phone calls from her friends, from her relatives, from some of the patients that she used to treat years ago that had become friends, asking me, why am I hurting my mother? And I said, hurting my mother? Yeah, I brought her favorite ice cream, her favorite flavor of Häagen-Dazs. I brought her favorite chocolates. And she said, oh, I can't eat those. David said they will feed my cancer. What's the matter with you? She was given 3 months to live. Why don't you let her have all the things she likes during those 3 months? I said, well, we're already at about 3 months. She hasn't gotten any worse. I'm trying to extend her life and maybe save it. They were really furious with me. But by the time we got to 6 months, and she didn't really need the pain patches anymore. Her hair was growing back from the chemo they'd given her in the hospital, and the pain was pretty much totally gone. And then 7 months, and then 8 months, and now she's up, and she's walking, she's feeding herself. They were no longer angry at me. Now they were rather amazed that I had done these things with her to get her feeling better. And it just kept on going. Somewhere in the neighborhood of, I think it was 12 months, I'm not exactly sure, she flew out to visit me in San Diego and to visit some friends of hers. She was walking 2 miles a day. She felt, basically, she said, I feel better than before I got sick. Well, of course, you've been eating perfectly for a year. You never ate perfectly for a year. So she was feeling great. Everything was going great. And then at some point, and I didn't write the exact time down, it might have been 14 months, 16 months, I noticed she hadn't called me to let me know what she was low on. That was one of her very few jobs. Let me know a week or so before you're out of something so I can send you more. And I called her up and I said, Mom, what's wrong? And she said, nothing's wrong. I feel fantastic. This is great. You know, I'm eating the foods that they're giving me. I said, no, but you have to be running out of things. I stopped taking all those pills and powders and liquids. I said, you did what? She said, well, I couldn't tell they were doing anything. I said, are you kidding me? You were supposed to be dead a year ago. Instead, you feel fantastic, and you don't have any problems that you know of, and you're saying you don't know if they did anything? She had switched into denial, and she continued to keep everything stopped. She started eating Häagen-Dazs and Sara Lee and carrot cakes and things that people were bringing her. And any time the people were saying, why are you doing that, weren't the reasons that got you well things you should continue, she just said, oh, I don't know if that really had anything to do with anything. And of course it did. She was supposed to be dead. So when she finally died, 2.5 years or so after her diagnosis instead of 3 months, and when I was at her funeral, I made a comment when I was the one up there. Everybody was up there talking and saying different things, and I purposely didn't wear a tie. I didn't wear a suit jacket. It was in a synagogue, but I didn't have a yarmulke on. And I made a joke, and I said, this is so her spirit that's hovering over her somewhere, you know, in this room, can recognize me because she knows I would never wear those things. And I said, what happened was she had been an unhappy lady for years and years and years and years, ever since she split up with my dad when I was 12. And she didn't feel loved because if he didn't love her, nobody could love her. That was her belief. It wasn't true. A lot of people loved her. Patients loved her, et cetera, et cetera. She didn't feel she could be loved or he wouldn't have left. And so she wasn't happy. But she wasn't suicidal. She was a state-certified psychologist. She helped many, many people. She wasn't going to take her life. But when cancer came back, I am certain to this day that she went, oh, wow, nobody can get mad at me for dying of cancer. I have my way out. I don't have to commit suicide. I'm going to die. I'll be dead in the next 3 months or so, and nobody will be mad at me, and I'll be gone, and I don't know whether she believed in the afterlife. She wasn't a religious person, neither am I. So I don't know what she thought would happen when she died, but she didn't have to be in this world anymore where she wasn't happy. And so when I proved to her, or her body proved to her, to be more accurate, that if she kept on eating well and taking the supplements, the cancer was going to get smaller and smaller, and she was going to win. And everybody doesn't win. But the fact that we were able to turn this around completely, so in 16 months, every single cancer spot in her body on the next bone scan they did was smaller. She felt fantastic. I mean, the doctors didn't even think it was her, because she should have been dead. So when you get that kind of reversal, you know this person is going to be able to make it if they just keep doing everything. She had to stop it all, because if she didn't stop it all, she was going to stay on the planet. And she didn't want to. She was only doing it to make her older son happy, not to try and cure the cancer. And so she had to stop it all. And so that taught me a couple of very, very important lessons, which I still talk about now, you know, that I've been doing this for 25 years full time. Lesson number one, that it's important to ask somebody, do you really like this life? Do you want to be here? Are there a bunch of things you can tell me over the next 10 years you'd like to be here for? And if a prospective patient says, not really, I go, well, you know, your body's not going to fight if your mind doesn't want to. You know, they both have to be in gear there. You're not going to be able to continue to do the things as vehemently as I want, most likely, if you don't want to be here. So give me a couple of things you want to be here for. And if somebody can't say, well, you know, my kids will probably find somebody and get married in the next 4 or 5 years. I'd like to walk my daughter down the aisle. Okay, that's a good one. But the people that can't come up with anything, that's a bad sign. So that's number one. You have to want to be here. And number two, which a lot of people don't believe, but my mother showed it to me really forcefully, is if you do everything necessary to give the body the strength to turn an illness around, and if there's enough time to do it, because if somebody comes to me and they've got a month to live, it might not be enough, but, you know, they told me she had 3 months. I said, let's give it a try. Then even if you don't want to be here, and she clearly didn't want to be here, the body will still properly react to the better food and the better supplements and pulling out all the things that you shouldn't be eating and will get the results even if the person doesn't want them. So when somebody says, this stuff isn't going to work, my dad doesn't want to be here, I go, well, I really do want them to be here, but will they do everything? Oh, yes, I'm the caretaker. I will see to it that he eats what he's supposed to. He takes all the supplements. But somebody told me if he doesn't want to be here, it won't work. I go, no. No, if he doesn't want to be here, there will be some issues probably in his body. But I have seen people that didn't want to be here, and their caretaker made sure everything was done correctly, and it still works. So those were two really important lessons that I feel I learned. And I guess I was supposed to learn them. If things happen for a reason, which I'm not 100% sure of, I needed to learn those lessons toward the beginning of my practice. And they're still important to me today.
Well, your practice is different from my practice. You deal with these physical problems of cancer and diabetes and heart disease and everything, and I deal with a spiritual problem of addiction. But I can say practically the same thing that I heard you say. If you don't have a reason for living, if you don't want to get well, you won't do what's necessary. And I've laid it out for you, but you're going to fail. And so I just thought that that was really interesting, that two different perspectives here all comes back to the same thing. You've got to have a reason for living. You've got to want to live, or else your body's going to take you out.
Yeah, yep. And there's a statement that's been around for a long, long time. If you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life. And I sort of feel that way. I mean, I love so much helping people get well that the weeks just, you know, vanish. I mean, you know, today's Monday. I take Sundays and Monday off. Tomorrow I start work again for the week. And in no time, Saturday will be here again, and I'll know the next day is a day off because I just love what I do so much.
Well, having a mission, a purpose, is probably the number one goal that I try to teach, that if you have that, you're going to have a totally different life than if you have no passion, no purpose, no mission, and you just go to a job 40 hours a week to make a paycheck. So, you know.
I completely agree.
Okay. There are a lot of questions I'd like to ask you because you're so knowledgeable about a lot of things. But let's see if we can hit the high points of a couple of them.
Sure.
Are antioxidants important?
Antioxidants are very important. We, as part of our metabolic process, do quite a bit of oxidative production. And those need to be quenched to an extent. We wouldn't want to turn off oxidation in the body because it's part of the metabolic process. If there was a fictitious little button, and if you press that button, everything that was working by oxidation in your body immediately stopped, you would drop dead immediately. So oxidation is important, but we don't want it to hurt too much other tissue, and so antioxidants are important. And it appears that the ones that are the most important are the ones that are vitamins and minerals that are essential for health. So the reason I'm saying that is because if somebody says, here's a great product that somebody told me about, usually end up being network marketed or multi-level. You like, I don't know, Moringa or Zango or all these different funny different things, some particular variety of blue-green algae or red algae. Are those necessary for life? We know they're not. How do we know that? Because each of those different substances was only discovered in a tiny portion of the planet Earth, and nobody else ever had them until somebody discovered them and started marketing them. And we had healthy people all over the planet. So the ones that are really important would be the ones that are antioxidant vitamins, because a substance cannot be classified as a vitamin unless it has been determined to be essential for long-term health. Nothing is called a vitamin that is not essential for long-term health. The amount we need varies, but you have to have some. So the antioxidant vitamins, such as vitamin C and vitamin E complex and vitamin A and a number of others, those are antioxidants that are really, really important. There are also some antioxidant minerals. Selenium has been shown to be antioxidant. That's required for long-term health, and too low a level increases your risk of various different types of cancer, and the body can't fight certain types of infections, viral infections, without enough selenium. So yes, antioxidants are important. There are many of them out there, some more important than others.
You talked about vitamin C. It's a water-based a vitamin, so you can take as much of it as you want and it won't hurt you. Is that right?
You can take as much as you want and it won't hurt you, with the exception of the fact that if you take more vitamin C than, for lack of a better way to put it, than your intestines like, you'll get diarrhea. And it might be that the amount you're taking is not more than the body needs, just your intestines don't like that much in concentrated form. But as long as you're not one of the few people that has that issue, yes, you could be taking 500 milligrams four times a day. You could be taking 1,000 milligrams four times a day. A lot of the vitamin C researchers that know how important it is take 2 or 3,000 or 4,000 milligrams four times a day or three times a day. But usually, because it doesn't stay in your body all day, it has to be taken multiple times, usually at least three, as opposed to things that are fatty. So vitamin A is a fatty vitamin. Vitamin E complex is a fatty vitamin. Fish oils are a fatty vitamin. That can be taken in one dose, and it will be in your body for 24 hours. But things like C, if you want to make sure you're not deficient at some point, you should really take them, preferably three times a day, but at least twice.
Okay. Let's talk about artificial sweeteners. There are a lot of them. There is one that's totally so far above the others as far as being a bad actor, and that is aspartame. That there's no question that nobody should put that sweetener in their body, period, ever. But is there a sweetener that has little or no bad side effects?
Yeah, I have found that of all the different sweeteners out there, the artificial ones I would never say that about. I would say they all have problems. If you put Jonathan Wright, one of my mentors, he says, if you put an alien molecule in your body that never existed until they made it in the lab, you're not doing yourself a favor. So all the artificial ones, I would cut them out. There's no reason for them. But as far as are there some sweeteners which don't seem to have any issues, Yes, there are a couple. My three favorite natural sweeteners, in no particular order, I might add, any of them, are stevia, which is one of the most mispronounced words in the health food store, because people say stevia, but it's actually something. It's a plant, and plants have botanical names, and the name is the stevia robordiana plant, so it's actually stevia. So stevia is a totally harmless sweetener. That doesn't mean, since it's an herb, that somebody couldn't be allergic to it, maybe one out of a million people, but, you know, that's a separate issue. So stevia, a very healthy sweetener, and there are a lot of different brands out there. My favorite brand, and I have nothing to do with any of these companies, my favorite brand is Stevita Corporation, because the guy who owns Stevita will not use the stevia that everybody else is using, because all the other stevia companies are buying Chinese stevia, whereas the owner of Stevita Corporation, he has his own stevia fields in Brazil. So, yeah, stevia, good quality sweetener. Yacon, Y-A-C-O-N, is a root vegetable. It looks sort of like a knobby tuber, like a big knobby piece of ginger or something. And if you cut it open, the inside looks white. You go, well, isn't that starch like a potato? No, looks like it, but it doesn't contain any starch. It's a soluble fiber. The body can't utilize fiber, but it's a sweet-tasting fiber. So if you concentrate it, boil it down into a syrup, sort of looks like molasses. It's very sweet. It's all a fiber that you're eating, so it basically has pretty close to zero calories. And it tastes like a combination of a light molasses and a light honey. Very sweet. Most people like it a lot, but it won't have any effect, except what happens if we eat a lot of fiber? You get diarrhea. So if somebody puts a huge amount on something, then you might get loose stool, but otherwise, no problem. And the third one is the monk fruit, or Lohan Kuoberry, from China. Usually spelled L-U-O-H-A-N, Lohan, but there are a couple of other spellings, common name being monk fruit. And that's a Chinese berry, which, like stevia, if you extract just the molecules in the nature that are sweet from either the stevia leaf or the Lohan berry, if you extract them and concentrate them, so you just have the part that's sweet, you will make it between 200 and 300 times sweeter than sugar, and so you don't need much to put in something, just a speck, and so you rarely get pure steviacides or pure mongricides from monk fruit because it's too hard to handle something that's 200 plus times sweeter than sugar, so they mix it in with some other non-harmful sweetening agent, usually a non-GMO erythritol or xylitol, so that it's more manageable. So stevia, Lohan, and Yacon are my favorite sweeteners, but the sugar alcohols that have less gastrointestinal problems than the ones that were used a long time ago. A long time ago, they used maltitol and sorbitol in all the candies when I was growing up. If somebody had three of those, they got diarrhea. Now they've switched mostly, the better companies, to erythritol and xylitol, and as long as you're getting the good quality ones, the non-GMO ones, those are another possibility. As long as you don't have too much of them, and they seem to be fine too, but it's a lot more processing to make them than the processing done to get Lohan or Yacon or stevia. So those are five.
Okay, let me ask you a question to make this a controversial dialogue.
Sure.
Should we eat beef, poultry, eggs, and fish, or should we be vegan?
Well, the best way to be able to find out an answer to that kind of question is always to do multi-generational historical research. What Weston Price and Francis Marion Pottinger Jr. and some other people have found is that changes occur in our DNA slowly, such that if you want to know that eating a certain way is healthy, you need to find some society that's been eating that way for a minimum of five generations, and that they're still in perfect health. There are no five-generation vegans on the planet Earth. It is my belief that it would be impossible for there to be any, because there are so many nutrients that are animal-based nutrients that aren't found in vegetable foods that I don't think you could still, I think you'd lose fertility before you got to even generation four. But that's the way you take a look. And all of the populations around the world, when they had perfect health, before they started eating our horrible diet, they ate all of those different things. However, all of those were, at that point, wild. Now we've domesticated them. And so they being the chickens, the other birds, fish, beef or cattle or buffalo, the lambs or sheep, they were all eating what Mother Nature, or if you're a religious God, intended them to eat instead of what we are feeding them to get them fat faster. And so when they eat what they're supposed to eat, it's a different food for it, and then it becomes a different food for us. And most of our listeners, most of your listeners, probably know omega-3 fats are a healthy fat. Most of them may not know that the healthiest omega-3 fats are the animal-based ones, EPA and DHA, not the plant-based ones like the ones in flax oil. And if you have grass-fed beef and you analyze it and you compare it to the regular feedlot grain-fed beef, the grass-fed beef have 500% more anti-inflammatory omega-3 fats in the beef. And so, no, I would never tell somebody to be vegetarian or vegan. I want them to eat beef and lamb and fish and sardines and scallops and shrimp, but I want it all to be wild-caught if it's going to be a seafood. I don't want it to be farm-raised. And if it's going to be raised by us because that's what's going on, I want it to be eating as close as possible to what it would have been eating if it was feeding itself out in the wild. And if we can manage, and we cannot always manage this one, I want it to be an old variety that hasn't been hybridized a lot. So if somebody's going to eat chicken or eggs, I would prefer if they could find some place in which the ranch has ordered in chicken eggs to hatch or chicks from what are called heritage or heirloom breeds, the ones that were healthy, the ones that wouldn't sit down there and couldn't do anything except blob and eat all day, but that if you went to go where they were, they would run away from you. If you ran after them, they would fly away from you, which none of the chickens anybody's eating today can do because they have lost the ability to run or fly because we've bred them to get fat fast, have more white meat, which is not quite as healthy as the dark meat. And so we're eating things that nobody ever ate hundreds of years ago. They didn't exist in that form, and they weren't eating the garbage that we're feeding them.
David, how did you get so smart?
You know, it's a hard question to answer. I found the Price-Pottinger Nutrition Foundation many, many years ago, and the works of Weston Price and Francis Pottinger were very instrumental in helping me to see that you can't take a look at a group that's been eating some way for 6 months and have that mean anything, because we now know that it can take years worth of doing the wrong thing before it shows up in the DNA. So that was part of it, being part of the Price-Pottinger Foundation. I think their website, the easiest way to get there is PP for Price-Pottinger, NF for Nutrition Foundation, ppnf.org, to understand that we have to look at traditional societies and how they were eating and how that food is different than what we are now. And then I just started reading research papers. And I'd read through a research paper and I go, what? Really? You must be kidding. They did everything wrong. That's not going to tell you anything. They didn't look at this right. They didn't look at that right. They looked at this to see whether this particular thing would cause a problem, and they only followed the people for 3 months. 3 months? I want to live to be 100. How about following them for 5 years? So if you really know what is required for research, and you buy the actual studies, and then if you go, as I do, to 5 or 6 scientific conferences a year to listen to the clinicians that are doing things in their practice and hear what they tell you, and then decide to try some of them and see which ones work, that's what's most important, because the stuff is not being taught in school.
Well, hey, I'm going to draw parallel here. When I interviewed Larry King a number of years ago, he had 35,000 interviews under his belt, and I had 150. So you can see how I might get intimidated. I said, Larry, you didn't graduate from high school. You got a GED. And yet, you're one of the smartest people that I know. How did that happen? And he said, well, you know, it's because I ask more questions of people than anybody you know, and I listen to what they have to tell me.
Yep.
And that is sort of what you're telling me, too.
Yes.
Is that you find people, you ask them what they think about this, that, or the other, and you actually listen and try to interpolate it into your own being, and you get smart.
Yes.
And so
there's actually another thing which is fairly important that most people don't think about. As a matter of fact, it's so important it made me put a separate area on my website entitled In Search of Unknown Facts. And that is that if everybody you know believes a particular thing, whatever it might be, I don't care, you know, you could pick something. Vaccines are good for you, silver fillings are healthy, fluoride reduces tooth decay, and there are lots of others. But I mean, almost everybody believes a particular thing. And then you realize that there are a few people that believe that whatever this thing is, that it isn't true. You have two choices. You can go, well, everybody knows that that's nonsense. I mean, you know, almost everybody believes this, that person's crazy. Or you can be like me. You can go, no, how has science moved forward over the decades and centuries? How is it that we have gone forward and started doing things that nobody thought we could do? Nobody thought you could have an internal combustion engine or a jet plane or even anything that could fly. Nobody thought you could have something that you could send something out here and you could hear it 500 miles away called radio waves. How did we do that? Well, somebody decided to experiment and look into something. And if you mention it to people, they'd say, oh, that person's a nut. And that person continued to be a nut and continued to look into it. So what I do is anytime I hear something that if it were true, this is the main thing, if it were true, I would want to know. However, almost everybody believes it's false. I will not ask any of the people that believe it's false. That's not going to help me any. I'm not going to read a book about it. I'm not going to ask a professor. They all think that person's an idiot. I will instead get on the web, and I will search and see if I can locate three or more credentialed experts. So in other words, I'm not looking for a parent or some bum that thinks something. I'm looking for somebody that also has a PhD or is a professor or an MD or a physicist or whatever. But they've looked into it and they go, ah, you know, I believe everybody's wrong, that they haven't looked at something correctly, and this is why. So you find three or more credentialed experts with this alternative view that very few people have. And I will then read their books, or I will watch their video exposés if they've had some, or if they've made a lecture, or if they've written a couple of papers. I'll go and do that for at least three of these. And by the time I'm done, I will either go, yeah, this person's a nut. These people are all crazy. Or I'll go, wow, they've got some really good points. I'm going to go find some more credential experts, because I think the 99% are wrong and the 1% is right. And I always want to be in the 1%. And I call the 1% those people that discover something way before the general population. And I get people at least once or twice a year, some student of mine or some patient of mine or a relative of mine that knows some of my beliefs will call me up and say, David, did you see the New York Times article or the Wall Street Journal article? They just discovered something that you taught us 15 years ago. And I just smile. And I go, yeah, well, obviously, they just discovered it, but a lot of other people discovered it first because I didn't make it up. I learned it from other people that were forward-thinking, and I looked into it and decided they were right and started teaching it that way.
Abundant Health in a Toxic World. That's the book that we're talking about today. Our guest is David Getoff. And I might add that David sent me a DVD computer disc package that I thought was exceptional, and you ought to look into getting that in addition to the book. You can go to his website, davidgetoff.com, and tour it, sign up to subscribe, and get a lot of information. And as you could tell by listening to our conversation today, David knows what he's talking about. And we made a very important point that everybody that listens to this message today ought to take to heart. If you don't want the risk of cancer at the rate that it is right now, if you don't want the risk of diabetes, if you don't want the risk of heart disease, change your way of thinking about sugar and starch. Start eating less and less of it, life will be different. You will live longer. You will live healthier. And, I'm so grateful that David came on the program today to give us this piece of information because it's life-changing. Thank you, David.
You are very welcome. I can only see so many patients in my office, so when I'm talking to a large number of people, such as through your show, or such as when I'm lecturing at a medical conference, or anything like that, it just makes me glow, because it means I'm giving information to a large number of people than I otherwise would if I just saw one person in my office.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, and maybe you can come back and do it again.
I would be more than happy to.